For Germany, taking in migrants isn't just a good deed, it's a good investment. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl for just one more day. It's Tuesday, September 8th, and we're happy you could join us. The mass movement of tens of thousands of people in Europe is starting to fray the bonds of the EU as countries take different approaches to welcoming or rejecting migrants and refugees. But this week, Germany offered to take 500,000 new migrants. The cost is north of $11 billion a year, but the German media is suggesting that the country isn't just motivated by doing the right thing. It's a self-interested question. In other words, the economic benefits of the migration may equal or even exceed the costs. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Germany figures each refugee will cost $14,000 to feed, house, teach, and pay a stipend of $160 a month. In the long term, though, economist and migration scholar Carlos Vargas Silva at Oxford thinks the country will make the money back, largely because Syrian refugees tend to be skilled and young.
Given how young they are and how many years they're going to be working in the future, it is likely that over time, that burden, that initial burden, is going to be paid back by their taxes and their contribution to the host economy.
There is evidence of a net economic gain, says Dimitri Papadimitriou of the Migration Policy Institute's European office, with this caveat.
The benefits won't begin to amass until 3, 4, 5 years down the road.
And to get that return, you have to invest. That is, settle refugees, give them asylum, train them.
And once people sort of graduate from these programs, once those gaps in qualifications are filled, people should have an opportunity to go directly into the labor force.
A German labor force that's aging and shrinking from 45 million people today to about 36 million in just 15 years. That's assuming no immigration. It needs workers to fund the retirement system. In fact, much of Europe does, even though taking in outsiders is a hard sell politically. Jackson Janes runs the American Institute for Contemporary German Studies at Johns Hopkins.
Germany does have an opportunity here to show a way to cope and talk about it without it getting chewed up into polemics. It's certainly going to be tested very severely in the coming months.
One voice inviting in refugees is the head of Mercedes-Benz. He says those are exactly the people we're searching for. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
More on President Obama's Labor Day executive order, which provides 7 days of sick leave per year to the employees of federal contractors. That'll benefit about 300,000 American workers. But the president is asking Congress to approve legislation extending sick leave to the private sector. Some states and cities are ahead of the curve, requiring companies to provide that coverage already. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has more on their experience.
Connecticut, San Francisco, and Seattle are among the places where mandatory paid sick leave has been introduced and studied.
For most employers, having to provide paid sick days for your employees turns out to largely be a non-event.
Eileen Applebaum is a senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. She looked specifically at the case of Connecticut, which was the first state to require paid sick leave back in 2011. Most businesses said sick leave didn't cost them anything, and only 1 in 10 said costs rose more than 2%.
The main way that they handle this is by temporarily assigning the work to other employees, or they put the work on hold, or if you're talking about a restaurant or a retail establishment, they allow employees to swap shifts.
In a San Francisco study, about 14% of businesses saw negative impact on profitability from offering paid sick leave. A study in Seattle showed most employers weren't able to calculate the costs. But of the few who did, it amounted to about 0.4% of revenue. Max Nelson is labor policy analyst with the Freedom Foundation. He says one thing that paid sick leave doesn't seem to be doing is keeping sick employees from coming to work.
About 4 of the 5 studies that have been done that look at workplace illness in the wake of a mandatory paid sick leave law have found no reduction.
That may be one reason why several studies see the costs of paid sick leave as so limited.
Workers are definitely not using all of their paid sick days.
Jessica Milley is with the Institute for Women's Policy Research. Her organization did a study in San Francisco.
Rather, we think that they're mainly using it as kind of an insurance policy.
All in all, there are 3 states and 19 cities that require paid sick leave. 44 million private sector employees don't have any paid sick leave at all, according to the White House. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
On Wall Street Today, a frothy little buzz. We'll have more when we do the numbers. There's Uber, there's Lyft, and as it turns out, there's also an Uber or Lyft for kids. Shuttle is billed as a ride-sharing service for the busy family who needs help getting kids to and from school or soccer or swimming. Shuttle isn't cheap compared to old-fashioned carpooling or asking the babysitter to do it. Rides cost a minimum of $12 or $8 for a carpool, and there's also a $9 a month membership fee. And then, of course, you have to be okay with putting your kid in a car with a stranger, even if that stranger has been through all kinds of background checks. I went for a ride with a pint-sized shuttle customer the other day.
I thought it was really cool. It was like, it saved my parents a lot of time, and it's pretty nice.
But that's the Bay Area, where people and even kids are used to expensive tech solutions to normal problems. Shuttle could be a hard sell somewhere else. So I asked founder and CEO Nick Allen about it. Nick, thanks for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm thrilled to be here.
So how does this idea come about? It's a different business model, right?
It is.
From Uber and Lyft. It's partly subscription. It started at the beginning. Where did it come from?
Well, I was one of the founders of Sidecar. It was the first sort of peer-to-peer transportation company. And when we launched in LA, to my surprise, parents started putting kids in the car. And we would get calls into our support line from drivers saying, I have a 10-year-old kid in the back of my car. What am I supposed to do? Lyft and Uber and Sidecar, those companies aren't really built for that. Mm-hmm. And it really exposed to me the need that busy families have to kind of remove transportation as a barrier in their life.
And I feel like I have to ask you the obvious question here. Do you have kids?
I don't have kids.
I'm a parent. How do you look me in the face and say, you can trust me?
I've been around this business a long time. I know so much about what goes into the reliability, the safety, the background check screening, and the entire company is filled with parents as well. You know, our lead designer, our head of family experience, and all of that goes into making the service end-to-end something that you can trust.
We tell our kids, don't get in cars with strangers. How do you make it feel like a safe experience to them?
These aren't really strangers. You know, these are people in your neighborhood. Because we're scheduled ahead of time, we're allowed to exist in places that on-demand doesn't work very well, where if you tried to get an Uber, it's almost impossible. But for us, you know, we've gone out and we really appealed to the nannies, teachers, and babysitters of the world to give them an economic opportunity to drive for us. And that gives an experience that parents can trust and kids can enjoy.
Talk about the process of hiring someone. What are the requirements?
So they go through a very deep background check. That's first and foremost. We do a deep screening of their vehicle. We interview them. They have in-person training. And then to back it all up, we have specialized insurance that covers us for transporting minors. We have staff on hand watching every single ride. And we'll always evaluate new methods to help make sure that it's end-to-end safe as possible.
Tell us a little bit about your drivers. Who are they and where do they come from? You mentioned caregivers.
Right, exactly. You know, one of the things that really differentiates us from the other services is predominantly our drivers are women. When I created Sidecar, one of the things I was so proud of was this created a big economic opportunity for people, but it was mostly a male economic opportunity because rightly or wrongly, women oftentimes look at these other services as unsafe. You know, they're driving at night, they're driving in a neighborhood that they don't know. And for us, women are really attracted to the offering that we have because it's in the daytime. You know where you're going ahead of time and our passengers are safe.
And are the drivers, it sounds like they're independent contractors?
Yes, they are.
So do you think that that really rigorous hiring process, is that sustainable in the kind of independent contractor or gig economy?
Yeah, you know, I really think it is. And this is a big question that's facing everybody in this space. Most of our drivers, if not all of them, really have other part-time and full-time jobs. And if they were all to be made employees, that would kind of take that flexibility away from a lot of people.
And can you be any more specific about the funding that you've gotten so far or your upcoming expansion?
Yeah, we've raised $12.5 million so far in two rounds of financing. 2016 will be our year of getting to new cities. Places like LA and Chicago and New York and Houston, Dallas, DC, all ones that we're looking into as great markets for us.
Nick Allen is founder and CEO of Shuttle. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you want to hear my complete interview with Talia, the little girl who took shuttle the other day, visit our website at marketplace.org. In a little more tech news, Verizon has started a new mobile-only streaming TV service that eventually will even become available to non-Verizon customers. It's called Go 90, as in flip your phone 90 degrees to watch videos, and it's free, which, as we all know, is just another way of saying you are the product. Marketplace's Nova Sappho reports.
It's been almost 2 years since Verizon bought up Intel's video streaming technology. Since then, Verizon spokesperson Alberto Canal says they've been putting TV watchers, ones in their teens to early 30s, in a room and taking notes.
And you'd have some great content on the TV, yet they'd all be focused on their mobile devices.
Canal says that's why Go 90 is strictly mobile. It allows viewers to share content on social networks and chat while still glued to their phones.
We don't think that exists today in the best of shape.
Go 90 is also Verizon's attempt to take market share from cable TV, says James McQuivy of Forrester Research.
Pay television is facing really an erosion right now.
McQuivy says the big question is whether Verizon can sell enough ads to make enough money to buy expensive content. Otherwise, it won't be able to compete with the likes of Netflix and Amazon. McQuivy says to sell enough ads, Verizon needs to know more about its customers.
You might be using Facebook or YouTube on your Verizon phone, but Verizon doesn't actually get to know what you're watching.
Go 90 could change that, and Verizon's recently acquired AOL ad technology could make it easier to target viewers. And then there's the data charges. The service will start up with on-demand content from 15 cable channels, live sports, and concerts. Michael Wolf is an analyst with Next Market Insights.
The more data you use if you're Verizon, the higher mobile data tier you're going to be.
Verizon's Alberto Canal says, no.
People are using data already.
It's a multi-screen world, he says, and Verizon needs to be there. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
As it turns out, Apple has a big event tomorrow. It's mainly about the next iPhone, but let's be honest, there's only so much more amazing you can even make a phone at this point. So we are also expecting a big focus on the Apple TV. Maybe not a full-fledged cord-cutting TV subscription service, but a lot more on streaming video and even gaming. I'll be reporting live from that event. Watch marketplace.org for updates and our Twitter feed at Marketplace. Coming up.
But there's something called the urinal theory. It's predicated on the men's restroom.
I swear this is actually a story about casinos. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 390 points, 2.4%, to close at 16,492. The NASDAQ was up 128 points, 2.7%, to finish at 4811. The S&P 500 rose 48 points, 2.5%, to end the day at 1969. What a relief. Pretty big news from the world of air travel after the bell. United Airlines chairman and CEO Jeff Smyzik and two of his senior executives have resigned, apparently as a result of an ongoing federal investigation. We'll be keeping an eye on that as it develops. Oscar Munoz is the new CEO. He's been president of the railroad operator CSX since February and is a United Continental Holdings board member as well. Shares of United descended a bit in after-hours trading. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.18%, and you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. You've probably heard the term gamification. It's the idea that if you make something, whether it's learning or business or marketing, more like a game, people will be more interested in it. Or, according to Jane McGonigal, treating life like a game can actually make your life better. Jane is a games researcher who invented a game called Super Better. That's also the title of a book she wrote that comes out next week. Her team just finished a phase one clinical trial for treating post-concussion syndrome. That was funded by the National Institutes of Health. And peer-reviewed research released this week shows that Super Better techniques can reduce depression and anxiety
and improve concussion symptoms. I talked to Jane about her book and those findings. Jane, thanks for coming in.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So tell us about Super Better. It started as a game, and the game is now the book. Is that the right progression?
It started as a game, which I actually invented when I was healing from a mild traumatic brain injury. And I decided to use everything I knew about the psychology of games to try to help me with the depression and anxiety and social isolation that comes with being concussed. And after I played the game, I blogged about it. Other people started playing it for depression, anxiety, PTSD, I mean, lots of different mental and emotional challenges. And it just turns out that all of the things that researchers say to do if you want to experience post-traumatic growth are ways of thinking and acting that we naturally do when we play games.
And I like how you call it gameful thinking. Can you talk about sort of the intersection of that kind of thinking and social change potentially?
Sure. I mean, gameful thinking is really about facing challenges with a focus on possible positive outcomes. You are always thinking about what can I do today to increase the likelihood of a successful outcome. It's very goal-oriented, which of course, when we play games, we're very goal-oriented. We're thinking about the score we want to achieve or the puzzle we have to solve or the level we want to complete. That flexibility of mindset is really key and is beneficial not just for personal health, but also for social change could be.
I mean, so you've actually, not only did you design it and write this book, the book includes similar exercises, right, and similar activities to the game?
There are 100 quests that you can complete as you read the book so that by the end of the book, you are basically a master game designer yourself. Because really, Super Better, it's not a game that you play. It's learning how to game design your own life. For example, you learn how to collect and activate power-ups. Power-ups in a video game are things that make you stronger, faster, more powerful. And in daily life, it can be hard, especially when you're going through a challenge, to take the time to do things that are actually going to impact you positively. And the same with bad guys. You know, we encourage you to identify things that are causing you stress or anxiety or getting in the way of you achieving your goals. In everyday life, most of us, we stick with the same strategy. We're hesitant to try new methods of solving problems or making personal change. But in games, of course, we try multiple strategies, and we don't worry about if it'll work or not. If it doesn't work, we'll try something new. We have this incredible flexibility. And so to bring that to your real life, identify your bad guys, and we teach you to come up with 5 different types of strategies for every problem before you start trying to wrestle with it.
We've heard about gamification for a long time, gamification of all kinds of industries. Do you feel like your findings and your experiences suggest that gamifying life should be broader? That it is actually a promising strategy for all kinds of areas?
Well, when I started looking at the research literature, I was finding an incredible range of uses for games in treating mental health. And lots of people have heard the studies that have been coming out about Tetris being used to prevent flashbacks and PTSD mm-hmm. symptoms if you play it within 24 hours of witnessing or experiencing a trauma. We've seen games that control pain in burn victims more effectively than just treating them with morphine. There's so much out there in the literature. I'm certain that games will become a primary means for helping with anxiety, depression, chronic pain, and traumatic brain injury.
Jane McGonigal is the author of Super Better, which is out next week. Thanks so much for coming in.
It was my pleasure.
And now, the latest in our I've Always Wondered series. That's the segment where you, dear listeners, ask us questions and our reporters answer them.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer. By brain work and blade work.
This week's question comes courtesy of 29-year-old Brandon Bielik.
I've always wondered, how do casinos determine which slot machines to include and when to swap them out?
Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes it from there.
This is the kind of question that requires on-the-ground research. So I met Brandon Bielek at the entrance to Isle Casino in Pompano Beach, Florida, near Fort Lauderdale, about 15 minutes from his house.
Brandon. Hey. How are you doing?
Great to meet you.
So great.
Brandon tells me he started wondering how casinos decide which slot machines to buy and when to retire them after he won on some machines, returned to the casino later to play them again, and couldn't find them.
So there's a part of me that's a little cynical that thinks, oh, well, maybe I was winning too much, and there are other people as well who are winning on it, and just wasn't in the best interest to keep that machine around.
Is he being cynical, or is he right? I put his question to the experts, but before we get to that, Brandon and I head into the casino.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
All right, let's go.
We stake out spots at penny slot machines. We're not exactly high rollers, but Brandon is winning.
Oh, 5 cents, right? Yeah.
5 cents.
Yay! Hey, right, 10 cents.
10 cents.
But our luck didn't last. Over lunch in the casino deli, we tally our losses. $4.96 for me. For Brandon?
I lost about $21. A little more than I wanted to, but, you know, not bad for a couple hours of entertainment.
And that's part of the answer to Brandon's question. It's really hard to get casinos to talk about this, but former casino workers and academics on the subject tell me the bottom line is this. Casinos are in the entertainment business. They want slot machines that are entertaining, so they attract lots of players.
The casino is just like any other business. You have to have something that people want to come in and buy.
That's Greg Joslin. He worked at a casino in Mississippi for 17 years. He says state laws only allow casinos to keep a certain portion of every dollar fed into a slot machine. While each spin is random, the total take is controlled by a computer chip. But if people aren't playing a machine, it's not taking in any money. And a casino will think about getting rid of it or moving it. Casinos do have some theories on where to put their slots. Some are a bit unusual.
There's something called the urinal theory.
That's Anthony Lucas, a professor of casino management at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And yep, you heard him right.
It's predicated on the men's restroom.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
And the first guy that goes in will go to the end of the line of urinals. The second guy will go to the furthest one from the first guy.
Who knew? That's certainly something I've never wondered.
And that's the same way banks of slot machines fill up.
Aha. So a casino might put an unpopular machine in a popular spot. I try to explain the urinal theory to Brandon after we've left the casino and are standing outside again chatting. It's a bit awkward, but he gets the point, even agrees with it. He understands why people want their space when playing slots.
I like to spread out. So yeah, I think if it came down to it and I had a full row to row to choose from, I'd probably take the end. Yeah, the last urinal.
So did I answer his question?
Yeah, you definitely answered my question.
With maybe a little too much information. In Pompano Beach, Florida, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
This series only works with your help, so if there's something that you've always wondered or you want one of us to pay you a visit, go to marketplace.org/wonder and let us know. You can also find the questions, the answers to some of the questions we've already answered, like how rental car companies actually make money and why sticks of butter are long and skinny in the East but short and fat in the West. That's at marketplace.org. This final note before we go, we've been hearing a lot about the new Tesla model lately. You know how the Model S got that perfect score in Consumer Reports, and then the Model X is coming on September 29th with its so-called ludicrous mode. Well, Toyota has had enough. That company is announcing its 2016 Prius tonight at a media-only event in Las Vegas. And that is unusual. Toyota has never had an event in Vegas before. And to many watchers of the auto industry, the timing seems, well, related. It's the first complete redesign of the Prius since 2009. I'm betting it'll look a little like a Tesla. Oh, and one more final note. Yesterday, I did an interview with Anastasia Marx de Salcedo. She wrote a truly fascinating book about the influence of the military on the food we eat. And if you missed that or any of the great coverage we've done lately, you can always find Marketplace episodes on our website, marketplace.org, or subscribe to them as podcasts in your favorite podcast app.
All right, that's our show. It was a good day on Wall Street. The Dow gained 390 points, or 2.4%. The NASDAQ was up 128 points, 2.7%. And the S&P 500 rose 48 points, 2.5%. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner, and the senior digital producer is Nishat Kirwa. I'm Molly Wood, and we'll see you again tomorrow. Have a great night. This is APM.